Have you ever thought about the feeling of relief? Like taking a minute to think about that? It's kind of a weird question to ask. I understand that, but there isn't often a time when relief isn't coveted, isn't a welcome word. The relief of stress, the relief of some kind of pain, the relief of hunger that's building inside of our stomachs in the time that we're here talking. In a lot of ways, we work for relief, don't we? We work for relief. Literally, we go to work so that we can be relieved of the worry of where our next meal comes from. Isn't that a great thing to be relieved of? Now you can go into your refrigerator, you can go into your cupboard, you can look on your counter, you can come to the church and you can find food, and people have worked in order to provide those things. But there comes a time when work introduces a whole new set of stresses and worries that we find that we need relief from the work that brings us relief. Isn't that an interesting thing? We find a lot of hope in a future relief. Statements like, "this too shall pass," are things that we say to remind us that this stressful, worrisome, painful moment is only temporary, that relief is coming someday. Relief comes when something unpleasant ends, which means for there to be the experience of relief, something unpleasant has to be a reality. And so today, we're going to find a little relief in Micah. If you haven't been here, you've been a guest with, or if you are a guest with us here this morning, we've been walking through the minor prophet of Micah. And if you read those first three chapters, man, it's a doozy, right? Would you agree? Those of you that have been listening here, you'd be like, oh my gosh, it's a doozy. But today in chapter 4, the tone shifts. It shifts. But it also brings about the hope of relief for us, for the people that God was speaking to in that time, because we're going to see God raising, we're going to see God remaking, we're going to see God promising to gather and redeem what was ruined by really his own people. And so the first three chapters of Micah have been a firestorm of judgment. God is done with the way the leaders of his own people have been acting, and God chose to speak through Micah to not just the leaders, but the people as well. And we read this not because it was written to us. Something important to understand. God didn't write these words to apply specifically to your life, but it was preserved for us so that we might be able to peer in on the nature and the character of God, that some of these things do, in fact, apply to us because this God is our God. And so the words were preserved for us so that we can learn about him, about ourselves even, and about the relief that is coming in and through his son Jesus, in and through the Spirit of God. Remember the crazy that was in chapter 3 last week. God spoke in terms of leaders figuratively cannibalizing the people that they led, grifting off of their successes, what possessions they had, and hiding behind the God they claimed as their protector, as they protected nobody but themselves. Remember the irony of that? As a result, God promised at the end of chapter 3 that Jerusalem would become ruins. Zion would be plowed like a field. The temple, the place where God dwelt among the people in that day, would become a high thicket. This matters because Micah 3 did not end with ruined pagans or obvious enemies of God. It ended with religious people who thought they were safe. They had the temple, they had the priests, they had the prophets, they had the language of faith. They could say, "Isn't the Lord among us?" But they had turned the presence of God into a slogan while refusing the ways of God. That is what we call false security. And Micah 4 shows us that future peace where false security ends. It shows us true and lasting relief. So if you have Bibles, I'd love for you to turn to Micah chapter 4. It will be on the screen for you, but let's read the first two verses. God says through Micah, "In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house will be established at the top of the mountains and will be raised above the hills. Peoples will stream to it, and many nations will come and say, 'Come, Let us go up the mountain of the Lord to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us about his ways so we may walk in his paths. For instruction will go out of Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. The place that was ruined, the place that was plowed, the place that had become a high thicket will, God is promising, one day again become the place that people see as the mountain of the Lord. And in fact, it's not just that mountain, but it's going to be established even higher above other mountains, high above the hills, and people will stream to it, it says. So think about this. I don't know, how many of you have seen mountains before? Or have you just stayed in Lapeer County your entire life? All right. So we've seen some mountains, and they're majestic, aren't they? They're beautiful, and you're just like, wow, like that one touches the clouds. And just imagine this day that the Lord is talking about, it's going to be even higher than those mountains. What God is going to establish is going to be seen farther than the mountains that have already been established. And then he says the people will stream to it. Think about that for a second. Because what do streams naturally do? What way do they flow? They flow down the mountain, right? They flow down the mountain. A stream naturally flows downhill. It doesn't climb mountains. God uses that word purposefully to communicate a specific truth about his kingdom. We are drawn to the things that seem natural, right? Like, maybe not so much in these days, but when I was growing up, a big slogan was, do what feels right, right? Whatever feels natural, go do that kind of thing. We don't need someone to preach that to us, do we? If it feels good, do it, right? If it tastes good, eat it. If you got an itch, scratch it. Have you ever tried not to scratch an itch? Bothers you. Me too. We do what is instinctive. But in this single word, God is promising a reality where people are going to so crave the Lord's presence that they will be drawn uphill. In fact, God says that the nations will be drawn in verse 2. Why? Because they will be able to learn about God's ways so that they may walk in his paths. Who's choosing to go up the mountain? The people. God's not pushing them, right? He's not behind them like trying to lead a horse to water sometimes, right? And just like getting them in the back end and pushing them up the hill. No, no, no. They're drawn to it. They crave it. They want it. Let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, because he will teach us about his ways so that we may walk in his paths. They desire his paths. They desire to learn God's ways. And so where chapter 3 ended with us longing for a better leader, God is promising a future where that longing is satisfied. God has effectively become the one the world looks to for guidance and advice. They will be taught by God and brought in under his judgment. And this is a beautiful promise. It's an incredible picture. But what is God telling his people in this moment? Is that God will raise what sin has ruined. You see, this is a two-pronged promise. God is promising exile from the land that he had given to his people, but he's also promising a return. You had to leave the place in order to return to it, right? God is promising an exile. We saw that in chapter 3. We're going to see it again in this chapter 2. But he's promising a return. And this is not an uncommon promise in Scripture. Adam and Eve were exiled from the Garden of Eden after their rebellion, but even as God pronounced the curse, he gave the promise that the serpent would not win forever. From the beginning, judgment was not the end of the story. Even as we walk through the valleys of the shadow of death, God promises a return to the dream that is on every human's heart, one of provision and relief. The end of evil and the reign of righteousness. God is not merely waiting to rebuild ruins here. He is promising something that is far more glorious. The dwelling place of God becoming the hope of the nations. Not just one nation, not just Israel, but the nations, the world. where all people are drawn, compelled, desire to worship the Lord. And that is good news for you and me, because the place that was ruined, plowed, overgrown will one day be established as the mountain of the Lord. And that's not a get you through today and string us along kind of a promise. That is a resurrection hope kind of promise. God is not pretending the ruin is less serious than what it really is. He's promising that ruin will not have the final word. God will raise and make new what sin has ruined. We're in that kind of a culture today, right? The washing machine breaks, and you do what with it? You try and fix it, but most of the time you replace it because the parts are about the same amount as a new washing machine, right? Yeah. That's the way we live today. We lament that fact today, because a lot of resources are wasted. But what God is promising is not to return you to the way that you were one day, right? Because sometimes we long to go back to before we were aware of certain things, or before we were aware of our own sinful nature, or before we were our innocence was stolen from us, before that regret happened. Sometimes we wish for God to take us back in time to piece the pieces back together, and hopefully the cracks won't show through. But that is not what God is promising. He's not promising to rebuild what once was. He's promising to make new. He's promising to make something brand new. Because I don't know about you, but if I get this body when I get to heaven, I'm going to be like, that was a bad deal. Right? I don't want this body no more. I want it to be ash to ash and dust to dust, right? Because the new resurrected body, I don't know if I'm going to be able to like transform and like be a transformer and have wings and, you know, do all that kind of stuff. Like, it might be kind of cool. We see Jesus poofing around in the New Testament. I definitely want to do that, because you know how many people you can jump scare with that? That would be awesome. But like, you see what I mean? Like, God is going to make something new, and we can't even begin to imagine what that could look like or what that might feel like, because we have been living with regret, physical pain, limitations for so long. The promise is, I'm going to make something brand new. God will raise and make new what sin has ruined. And it will be better than what it once was. But notice this, God does not do this by preserving false securities. See, Zion had become a place, a hiding place for corruption. The temple was a religious exercise. That's all it was. The leaders had used God's name while ignoring God's ways. So God, what he is doing in his judgment, in this exile, he is tearing down what they falsely trusted. Not because he's done with them, but because he's preparing a peace that will actually hold. Likewise, we see people today whose lives have been laid ruined by sin, sin of others, and sin of their own. You and me, we experience the ruinous effects of sin that lives in our own bodies, and we find ourselves asking, who will rescue me from this body of death? Searching for some temporary relief in maybe a sermon, in a drink, in an activity, or even in prayer. But what God promises is far more than temporary. He's not going to patch back together the lives that we once had. Experiences with sin will absolutely change us, but God says that this evil will not have the last word. How is that, though? Once you've lost innocence, once you have a regret, a skeleton in the closet, once you learn to not be so trusting, how do you recover from that? What actually brings relief? Well, he does a little bit of vision casting here, I guess you could say. He talks about what this might actually look like in a couple of ways. The first way is in Micah 4:3-5. He says, God says he will settle disputes among many peoples and provide arbitration for strong nations that are far away. Can you imagine if God came and sat at the table between, you know, the United States and Iran right now? That would get solved pretty quick, wouldn't it? I think so. He says they will beat their swords into plows and their spears into pruning knives. Nation will not take up the sword against nation. They will never again train for war. But each person will sit under his grapevine and under his fig tree with no one to frighten them. If you are making notes, that is a beautiful promise. No one to frighten them. For the mouth of the Lord of armies has spoken. Though all the peoples walk in the name of their own gods, we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Micah's message so far has been primarily aimed at these national leaders who hate what is good and love what is evil. He said that at the beginning of chapter 3, right? And it's left so many wishing for better leaders. And while it wasn't as often as we experience, there is this cycle of hope and disappointment that happens in our politics, in our national leadership, right? There's as one leader vacates their role, there's hope that things will be different when the next leader enters into the role, but it's rare that a national leader leads in a sacrificial way. But here, God promises to be that better leader. God promises to bring relief. How does he promise to bring relief? He says he will be the judge and the arbiter. He will be the judge and the arbiter. He's going to step in with perfect kindness and perfect judgment and settle dispute among people and nations. Can you imagine what would happen in your marriage if every time you had a conflict and you sat down at a table or in your bed or whatever it is that you hash those things out when you finally get to that point? And then God came in and pulled up a chair looking at the both of you. Do you think some of your games that you play, would you be able to get away with those? Nope. No siree. We'd all be like, straight shoulders, you know. I'm sorry, right? Like, it would just be a crazy thing. And I think that's maybe one of the most misunderstood things about marriage is that marriage isn't just the two of you. Marriage is really three of you who God has joined together. Let no man separate, right? And that no man separate, no human separate, that includes the two people there. What God has joined together, God is in supernaturally bringing those people together. But this is relationships across the board. Nation against nation, person against person, business against business, church against church, church member against church member. God will be the judge and the arbiter. He's going to step in with this perfect kindness and perfect justice. And the result, without a command in the language here, what does it say? It says, they will. I want you to notice that. They will choose. They will decide. Their action that they are going to take, the people, the nations, will, of their own choosing, beat their swords into plows and spears into pruning knives. This isn't just peace. This isn't just, all is calm, all is bright, right? This is repurposing. All of the energy and strength that once went into war and retribution and extracting justice, where the system had failed them, all of that energy, all of that drive gets poured into something that is profitable for more than just one person. What once harmed others is remade into something that nourishes others. Instead of taking life, God is talking about a future where the whole of humanity is cultivating life. Why? Because war has lost its purpose. God is going to remake what violence once weaponized, because violence will no longer be necessary when God's reign comes into its fullness. When God reigns, war has no reason to exist. That is unfathomable. What a relief, right? And I'm not just talking about gas prices and the current state of affairs. When God reigns, war has no reason to exist. which means the war that you make against certain people, the war that you make in your own household, the war that comes about when you're driving and somebody flips you off, right? That, all of that kind of war has no reason to exist when God reigns. There's this image that God paints here then, where each person will sit under their own grapevine and fig tree with no one to make them afraid. I don't know about you, but like, I love grapes, especially fresh grapes. But sitting under my own grapevine doesn't really sound all that fun. And I've had a fig before, a fresh fig. They do not taste like Fig Newtons, just so you know, all right? They are pretty good, but like bacon, you know? Bacon. Crispy bacon. Yeah. That sounds good. So to them, this meant prosperity, peace, provision. That's what it meant to them. For you, make it whatever you want to be. But the key here is that God is going to provide under their own fig tree, under their own grapevine, with, what does the verse say? No one to frighten them. We're not just talking about back alleys and dark places here. This kind of no fear is reaching across every place and every sense of a person. There's no more fear in your home around the dinner table. There's no more fear in your own backyard. I was one time taking my dog out so that he could, you know, do his thing outside, not in our house. And turned the corner of the house, and there was, I don't know what it was. It was dark out. It sounded like a big old German shepherd or something. It was just hanging out in the backyard, and we startled it. It startled us, and my dog is not socialized. It's a little tiny shih tzu. He couldn't do anything to hurt anything, really, you know, except for a lease. But startled us. And now, like, every time I go outside, I'm peeking around the corner just to make sure there's not a bigger dog out there, because one little chomp and Jaxter's gone, you know, like, it's not gonna make it. So no more fear in your backyard from whatever. No more fear when you walk down a city street or through a dimly lit parking lot. No more fear of the economy or the gas prices or the wars or the news cycle or a political party. No more fear of a family member. No more fear of sin and evil. No more fear of those things. This is what God is promising. Not only is he going to provide, but he's going to remove the reason, the drive, the craving for war. The future that God talks about here stretches beyond places and into the body. Anxiety is a specific kind of fear, isn't it? And lots of people are on medication for it. Not against that whatsoever, but wouldn't it be nice if we didn't need that? There's no more of that because no one makes them afraid. There's no more avoiding people and crowds. There's no more facing situations that make you nervous. And it's not because you won't face those situations, but because God has supernaturally renewed you so that that fear doesn't exist. No more wondering if you'll be accepted or ridiculed. Why? Because though all people walk in the name of their own gods, we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. And while not in full, we already get a glimpse of that, or at least we should be getting a glimpse of that. That's the church. Not the buildings. The people who claim the name of Jesus. The church. Who choose to lay down what was used for violence and walk in the example of Jesus, laying down their lives of sin to be used in and for the kingdom of God. Not necessarily in big mission, but how they bear with one another, how they show love, how they judge things rightly, how they love even when sin is in the mix. How they bear with one another. Some Christians cover over that sin and they don't make it a big deal that it should be, but other Christians ostracize if they find out you have a dirty habit. That's weaponizing the kindness and the grace of God. One of the ways that we know people take sin seriously is that they do not excuse it. But another way that we see that people take sin seriously is because they don't persecute because of it either. It's a fine line to walk, but the Christian who walks in the name of the Lord knows that the kingdom cannot be built by human hands. It can simply be received and enjoyed because salvation comes through Jesus Christ, the one who takes away the sin of the world. Guys, a church can't do that. A pastor can't do that. A national leader can't do that. I heard one pastor this week say that politics won't fix politics. It's not a political answer for the problems that we've got going on in our country and in our world right now. Religious rhythms and rituals can't even take away our sin. Only Jesus can take away our sins. Do you believe that? I mean, you got to shake your head yes because you're sitting in church this morning. But if you were sitting in your living room and somebody asked you that question, is it under your own strength that you're trying to come into the grace and the mercy of God, or is it because you've received what Jesus has freely given from the cross? Because that's kind of where God speaks through Micah next. Verses 6 through 8, he says, on that day, this is the Lord's declaration, I will assemble the lame and gather the scattered, those I have injured. I will make the lame into a remnant, those far removed into a strong nation. And then the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from this time on and forever. And you, watchtower for the flock, fortified hill of daughter Zion, the former rule will come to you. Sovereignty will come to daughter Jerusalem. What is God saying here? He's saying he will assemble the lame, gather the scattered, and those who by the judgment of the earth God has injured. Now, that last part, who God has injured, might trip us up a little bit. Might tempt us to think that God is into injuring people just because. That's not the spirit of it at all. God's judgment on these leaders of Israel is going to cause pain for the entire nation. When Jerusalem is leveled, when the temple is destroyed, when lives are upended in exile, it's going to cause grief and suffering and pain, and that's going to happen to some who did not deserve it. Those who were oppressed, those women that were taken from their homes, those children that have no inheritance to look forward to, these are the ones that are going into exile with the rest of the nation. So it's almost like insult to injury. But it's like when Elise is about to fall on her head because she's bouncing on the couch, right? She's been getting into a habit these days of standing up on the couch and, like, you know, walking and running down the couch. And she's not the most stable thing yet, right? And so she gets hurt. She doesn't watch where she's going, and she gets her foot right on the edge, and sometimes she slips over, and then it's kind of, if it wasn't my daughter, it'd be hilarious, right? Because she'd be like, you know, and do like a total cartwheel in the air. But we have an ottoman that's right next to our couch, and if she smacks her head on the side of that hard corner, she's going to hurt herself even more. And so what do? I see what's about to happen, and I might reach out and grab her, right? And sometimes the only thing that I can grab is an arm. And so if she's got momentum, that's going to pull on that shoulder pretty good, isn't it? And she's going to probably end up crying anyways because I actually did injure her in the process of saving her, right? But what would we prefer? A head injury or a dislocated shoulder? I use this all the time. I tried to think of a different way to say it. But if your kid's going to get hit by a car, you're definitely running into the street. It doesn't matter what you're grabbing. You're getting them out of the street. It may hurt them. They may skin their knee. They may get a dislocated joint. You're going to save them because it saved their life, no matter what you have to do to fix that. That's the spirit of what God is saying here. I've got to fix my people. I've got to fix my people, and it's going to seem harsh. It's going to hurt. You're not going to understand what just happened because you did not see what was coming for you. You did not see the future that was coming, but I promise you, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to provide for you. I'm going to bring you back together. He goes on and he talks about just the pain that he may cause when Jerusalem is leveled, when this temple is destroyed. There's going to be grief. But in order to prevent the spread of this sin that was happening in chapter 1, God saw it fit for his judgment to be sweeping. And God says, though some of you do not deserve it, I will preserve you. And so big picture, the lame cannot assemble. There's some people in our church today that cannot make the trek to church to be here with you all. They cannot assemble with us. The scattered don't know where to meet. They're not a part of the messaging system. They don't even know. The injured might be afraid to journey back. But God says, though you're not able to assemble, though you are not able to build my kingdom, I will bring you in. I will bring you in. And we see this over and over in the scriptures. We are inspired by flawed and broken men and women in the Bible. Noah got drunk, right? Abraham was too old. Jacob lied. Leah was overlooked because she had cow eyes, right? Moses, it's true. Read it. It's in the Bible, all right? Leah, David was like, I like your sister better. That's the story, right? Moses was a murderer. Rahab was a prostitute. David was an adulterer and a murderer. Naomi was a widow. Peter denied Christ, and Lazarus was dead. We do not remember them because they were impressive. We remember them because God was merciful. Because he gathered the weak, the wounded, the sinful people into his story. And through them, he bore witness to his grace. For these people, the God who made a way out of Egypt is saying, I will make a way back to the promised land, even though exile is in your future. And eventually, God declares, I will gather all of those who the world has discarded. The insignificant, the barely hanging on, those who have had nearly everything taken from them, the ones who feel they've given over to the temptation too many times, but are still fighting to lay those weapons down. God says, I will gather them. I will carry them. I will be their strong tower, because the kingdom of God comes not by what impresses human eyes and ears, but by the very grace and the mercy of the Lord our God. It cannot be built by sinful hands, but when sinful hands lay down their violent cravings, their hands are open to receive the very grace and mercy of the Lord our God. Chapter 4 ends with these words. Now, why are you shouting loudly? Is there no king with you? Has your counselor perished so that anguish grips you like a woman in labor? Writhe and cry out, daughter Zion, like a woman in labor. For now you will leave the city and camp in the open fields. You will go to Babylon. There you will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the grasp of your enemies. Many nations have now assembled against you, they say. Let her be defiled. And let us feast our eyes on Zion. But they do not know that the Lord's intentions or understand his plan, that he has gathered them like sheaves to the threshing floor. Rise and thresh, daughter Zion, for I will make your horns iron and your hooves bronze, so you can crush many peoples. Then you will set apart their plunder for the Lord, their wealth for the Lord of the whole earth. There's there's a lot here that I wanted to just go with, but I got 5-10 minutes left. So we're going to zoom in on verse 10. Melissa, would you mind? I didn't put that in there. Can we zoom in on 10 there? So let's look at Zoom 10, because this is something I think most Christians miss. You will go to Babylon. That's ultimately what God is saying. The nation will be exiled, and it is there that you will be rescued. There, the Lord will redeem you from the grasp of your enemies. This does not sound like a good plan to us. Would you agree? No. I don't want to journey into something like that. I don't want to be a part of pain. I don't want to be a part of suffering. So it doesn't sound like good news, but the principle is not that suffering itself is good. The promise is that suffering is not wasted in the hands of a redeeming God. Suffering is not wasted in the hands of a redeeming God. Christian, have you ever noticed that the scriptures often do not come alive until there is a pain that suddenly unlocks your understanding? You ever notice that? You read a verse, maybe you've read a verse for years, and then one day you're going through something and you're like, I finally understand what that means. If it hasn't happened to you, it will eventually. But I want to say this, you do not understand the power of sin until you yearn and long and fight against the sin that has become like a bear trap on you in the middle of a forest that you cannot break free from. You do not understand your own rebellion until you have been generous towards someone who's taken advantage of you, and still you decide, right? Because we've all been taken advantage of at one point or another. Is that fair to say? All of us at one point or another have been taken advantage of. But when you decide, even in that broken trust, to love and forgive that person and even continue on being generous, despite that, that is when our own rebellion becomes obvious to us. Because of how often we've taken advantage of the mercies of God, the grace of God, right? The provision of God. It's not until we actually see that go forth from our bodies that we actually get an understanding of, oh my gosh, this is how I've treated God most of my life. Many of us use worldly wisdom to stay away from being taken advantage of so often, instead of being in that situation, acting like Jesus, and then getting a realization of how seriously rebellious we actually are. You do not understand how God pursues you and loves you until you find yourself in a situation where you cannot turn your love for another human being off. And you long and you pray and you hope for their well-being or their return. You can read about it and know that these are God's responses. This is how God chooses to act towards you. But until you choose to go through that kind of suffering, staring sin in the face, and choosing the way of the Lord your God, you do not understand the gravity, the weight, or the glory of the Lord our God, who gave His one and only Son to a self-absorbed, thankless, rebellious people, so that they may not perish but have everlasting life. Because in that kind of pain, we understand. Much like how children, when they become parents, finally understand why their parents did what they did. And when we are on that end of it, we begin to see a whole different side of the goodness of God. Some of God's greatest redeeming work happens in the pain that God chooses not to immediately remove from our lives. And it's there that we find inexplicable relief. This is where Micah leaves us in chapter 4. Not with a cheap version of relief, but with a deeper one. Because God doesn't say, you'll never go to Babylon. He says, you will go to Babylon. And it's there that you will be rescued. It's there that the Lord will redeem you. That's not the kind of relief we usually ask for. We want the relief that keeps us from Babylon, keeps us from suffering, keeps us from pain, keeps us from upending our lives. We want the relief that keeps us from hard conversations or the painful consequence or the exposed sin or the loss, the grief, the waiting, the valley that we're in. But God gives a better promise than otherwise painless rescue. He promises his redeeming presence. There, I will be with you. There, I will rescue you. There, I will redeem you. All of that to say, I am with you. So there in the place you thought meant God had abandoned you, and there in the place where your false security finally collapsed, there in the place that where you could no longer pretend you were strong enough, wise enough, good enough, or safe enough on your own, there the Lord will redeem you. And that, my friends, is what we see at the cross. The place of redemption looked like God's absence. It looked like violence had the last word and evil had won. It looked like exile. It looked like the enemies of God gathered together and won. It looked like the king had been rejected and the hope of God's people were buried with Jesus in that tomb. But they did not know the Lord's intentions or understand his plan. At the cross, God was not losing, he was redeeming. And Jesus entered the place of judgment for sinners. He bore the violence of the nations. Jesus was cast out so the outcast could be gathered in. Jesus was wounded so the ruined could be raised. Jesus died under the weight of sin so that sin would not have the final word. And when he rose from the dead, he gave us the first fruits of the peace that Micah was able to see from a distance. A kingdom where swords would become plows. A kingdom where the lame are gathered. A kingdom where the scattered are brought home. A kingdom where every person sits without fear because the Lord reigns today and forevermore. So Christian, do not confuse temporary relief with true peace. A drink may numb it. A distraction may delay it. Money can cushion it. Politics certainly promise it. Religion disguises it. But none of that can redeem you. Let me say that again. None of that can redeem you. Only the eternal King from Mount Zion can. Only Jesus can. Future peace begins where false security ends. And false security ends when we stop asking created things to give us what only Jesus can give. So, lay the weapons down. Lay the pretending down. Lay the self-protection down. Lay the old securities down and walk in the name of the Lord your God. Because the mouth of the Lord of armies has spoken, and ruin and violence and exile will not have the final word. Jesus has the final word. And for all who belong to him, that word is redemption. What a relief. It's not on you. He has already made the way.